You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Balance in Teaching. This is Lecture 4. It is entitled, in fact, Balance in Teaching, given in Stuttgart on September 22, 1920. When we look at human beings and observe how they are constituted, and then apply this knowledge to the child, the developing human being, the following picture comes to us. Out of the spiritual world, into this one, comes, we could say, on astral wings, the human ego being. Observing children in the early years of life, how they develop, how by degrees they bring their physiognomy from the depths of their inner being to the body surface, how they gain more and more control over their organism, what we see in this process is essentially the incorporation of the ego. What really takes place here can be characterized in different ways, two of which are already familiar to you. I have recently emphasized how the organizing principle in the physical body emerges with the change of teeth, frees itself during this time, and shapes primarily the intelligence. That is one way of describing the process. Another way, however, stated earlier, when the whole subject was brought to our understanding from a different standpoint, is to say that the etheric body is born with the change of teeth. The first birth is of the physical body, but the birth of the etheric body is not until about the seventh year. What we call the birth of the etheric or formative force body can also be seen as the emancipation of the intelligence from the physical body, a two-sided description of the same phenomenon. We can grasp the matter only by observing two such aspects at the same time. In spiritual science, nothing can be characterized without approaching something from different sides, and then combining the different aspects into one comprehensive view. Just as little as a single tone comprises a melody, can a single characterization be enough for what spiritual science describes. You must characterize from different angles. In former times, people who understood something about this called it, quote, hearing the various explanations sound together, close quote. What else happens? Into the etheric body or intelligence, whichever you like to call it, into what has become free, streams the ego, which had already descended at birth and now works on the etheric body, bringing it gradually into shape. In this period, therefore, an intermingling takes place between the eternal ego and the slowly liberated intelligence or nascent etheric body. If we consider the next period from the seventh year to the 14th or puberty, we can say that in a sense, an element of will, a musical element, is being absorbed. Described from this angle, what happens is best described by the word absorbed, for the musical element really has its being in the outer world. The musical tone element, being absorbed, is indeed permeated by a pulsating, vibrating impulse coming from what spiritual science calls the astral forces. Thereby the astral organism becomes freed from its former connection with the child's total organization. We can then say with regard to the child that at puberty the birth of the astral body takes place. But again it is the ego, the eternal element, that unites itself with what is being freed, so that from birth to puberty, that is up to the age of 14 or later, we have a continuous anchoring of the ego in the entire human organization. After the seventh year, the ego settles itself only into the etheric body, whereas previously, while the human being was still an imitator, indeed due precisely to this imitative activity, it worked itself into the physical body, and later, after puberty, it establishes itself in the astral body. What we have then is a continuous penetration of the human organization by the ego. This whole array of facts has an immense significance for the educator. Fundamentally speaking, all teaching and instruction should constantly keep in view this integration of the ego into the rest of the human organization, as I have just described it. The process of ego integration should be guided by an artistic education, as I have indicated in an essay on education in the journal The Threefold Social Order. Footnote, see title The Pedagogical Basis of the Waldorf School, in title The Renewal of the Social Organism. Let me try the German here. Aufsätze über die Dreigliederung des sozialen Organismus und zur Zeitlage. GA 24, Anthroposophic Press, Spring Valley, New York, 1985. End of footnote. What do I mean by this? I mean, for example, that the ego must not be permitted to enter the physical, the etheric, or the astral too deeply, nor must it be too much excluded. When the former occurs, when it combines too intensely with the human organism, people become too materialistic. We will then think only with our brain. We'll be wholly dependent upon our organism. We become too much body. The ego is unduly absorbed by the organism, and this we must prevent through education. We must try to avoid everything that permits the ego to be too strongly absorbed by the organism or to become too dependent on it. You will understand how serious this is when I tell you that the cause of the criminality and brutality in people lies in the fact that their ego was allowed to be too strongly absorbed while they were growing up. When this has occurred, anthropologists confirm what are called symptoms of degeneracy in criminals. But these symptoms are frequently not discovered until they are well developed in later life, revealing that the ego of these people had become too deeply embedded in the rest of the organism. In the case of a child born with so-called criminal earlobes, it is all the more necessary to take special care that this does not happen. By means of truly artistic educational methods, we can prevent the ego from settling too deeply in the child's organism if there are symptoms of degeneracy. We can save such children from becoming criminals. We can, on the other hand, make the opposite mistake. The difficulty here is like using the balances in scales. We can place too much or too little weight on one side, and then we have to set the balance right. It is just like this with facts confronting us in life. In trying to rectify a mistake, we may easily fall into the opposite error. Living reality can never be expressed in rigid concepts, and in dealing with a child, it is the intimate elements of life that are all important. We must never develop one extreme or the other in a one-sided way, but rather the feeling that in education one has to create an artistic balance. When the teacher fails to induce a rightful fusion of the ego with the rest of the organization, it can then happen that the ego remains too far outside, with the result that the child becomes a dreamer or a visionary, or someone who will be generally useless in the world, living in the grip of fantasies. That is the other extreme, the mistake of not letting the ego sink deeply enough into the organism. But even children with a predisposition for dreaming, for false romanticism, for theosophy in the wrong sense, can be saved from becoming fanatics, unable to cope with life, if the educator sees to it that the ego is not unduly excluded from the rest of the organism, but permeates it in the right way. When one finds in a child the well-known characteristic of theosophists, a small bump rising a little way behind the forehead that all children inclined to theosophy bring with them, the important thing is to discourage the tendency to faddism and sentimentality by pressing the ego more strongly into the organism. But how can we achieve these two necessary results? We can accomplish something in both directions, by discovering the methods to cope with such needs, and these are the following. Everything in teaching that requires one to form mental images of number and space, like geometry and arithmetic, helps the ego to settle itself well into the organism when the child forms such images and works on them. Equally, everything in speech of a musical nature, rhythm, recitation, and the like, help in this. Music, especially the training of memory for music, will be especially beneficial for a somewhat fanciful child. These are the methods we must use to work upon a child whose ego does not seem to want to enter his or her organism properly, and who therefore might easily remain a victim of too great enthusiasms. When, on the other hand, we notice that children are becoming too materialistic, that the ego tends to become too dependent on the body, we need only have them draw those geometrical forms that are otherwise grasped more by thought. The moment we let the children draw geometrical forms, we create the counterpoise to an excessive absorption of the ego. You will see from this that it is possible to educate properly when we use the subjects of instruction correctly. If a child, because of talent or other reasons, is receiving special musical training, and we notice that they are becoming too dependent on their organism, that there is a certain heaviness in their singing, we must try to guide them to practice more spontaneous listening rather than musical memory. We can always look for a balance in these tendencies, either by helping the children to draw in their ego with the methods I have described, or by preventing the ego from becoming too drawn into the bodily organism. One of these conditions would certainly arise if we failed to maintain the right balance. It is especially good when we try to regulate things through the way we teach language. All the musical elements in language contribute to the absorption of the ego. When I notice that this happens too strongly, I take up something with the child that concerns rather the meaning and content of language. In this case, I will work in such a way that I call upon the child concerning the meaning of things. In the other case, when children are becoming dreamy or fanciful, I try to make them take up more the rhythmic element of language, meter and recitation. The teacher must acquire the ability to achieve this artistically, and in so doing can develop a certain sensitive sureness. Actually, there are whole subjects that help us when we want to protect the ego from being sucked into the organism too strongly. These are above all geography, history, and everything where the emphasis is on the picture element and on drawing. In history, for example, it is quite excellent to develop your story in such a way that it engenders vivid sympathy in the children, so that you call up in them veneration, love, or even hatred, provided the personality under discussion is contemptible. This participation of heart and soul is the important thing. And such a treatment of history can do a great deal to prevent the children from becoming too materialistic. But if through insight into child development, which we must acquire, we notice that through an overdose of this sort of history lesson, the children begin to show signs of fanciful dreaminess, we must try the other things that have been described. And all this must be integrated within the curriculum. It must be started at the right age. And therefore it is good to keep our eyes on the children for years. If we see the children becoming too dreamy through the stories of history, then when the right moment arrives, we must permeate the subject with ideas and with the great interrelationships in history. In short, individual treatment of historical events and personalities prevents the ego from being absorbed too much by the bodily organism, illuminating history with ideas that cover whole epochs stimulates the entrance of the ego into the organism. Too much drawing and too many pictures can easily lift the ego out of the organism with all the consequences we have described. When a child shows signs of instability as a result of drawing, painting, or perhaps even writing, the remedy is to have him or her understand the meaning of what they have done. Have them think, for instance, about the rosette they have drawn, or admire the forms of the letters of the alphabet, and thus become conscious of them. While mere writing and drawing take the children out of themselves, the observation of what they have drawn or written brings them back again into themselves. These things show us how we can use every detail correctly in our teaching when we develop it truly as an art. It is of enormous importance that we consider such things seriously. Take, for instance, the teaching of geography. On the whole, it tends to prevent the ego from being drawn in too deeply, and we can employ it with good effect with a child who is in danger of becoming too materialistic. We will lead such a child to an active interest in geography. On the other hand, if the child tends to become too dreamy and romantic through lessons in geography, this can be counteracted by making him or her grasp concepts such as the differences in altitude above sea level, or by leavening the geography instruction with other kinds of thinking more closely related to geometry. That will bring the ego back into the organism. The full value of all this will be appreciated only if we are capable of looking deeply into the wonderful structure of the human organism and its harmony with the whole universe. Just imagine what we have been observing, that the development of a child between birth and puberty is an interplay of the cosmic sculptural forces and the cosmic musical forces, naturally with the most diverse variations. Looking at the human constitution, you will find, as we have often pointed out, on the one hand the physical body and the formative force or etheric body, these two never separate between birth and death. They belong together in a certain sense continuously from birth to death. On the other hand, physical and etheric bodies separate in falling asleep. From the astral, first of all the etheric body from the astral body, and upon awaking they join together again. The etheric and astral bodies, we see, are less closely linked than are, for instance, the physical and etheric bodies. And like the latter pair, the ego and the astral body are closely connected and do not separate during sleep. Well, what are human beings then through our physical body here on earth? We are beings who live in reciprocal intimacy with the air around us. A given amount of air is at one moment within our physical body, at the next outside it. We breathe in, we breathe out. This breathing in and out reveals in a delicate way the difference between our waking and sleeping conditions. There is a subtle difference, and in matters of great importance it is usually the subtle differences that are most significant. What happens here through the interaction between the astral body and etheric body takes place in our waking state and in sleep as well. The interplay between the sculptural element and the musical during the formative years is the continual and mutual intervibration of the astral and the etheric bodies, in which the ego vibrates with the astral, the etheric with the physical body. You see, we human beings really breathe in our ego and astral body upon awaking, and breathe them out again upon falling asleep. This is a sort of greater breathing process that we can compare with the lesser one. Actually, every time we fall asleep, we emerge from our physical and etheric bodies and enter into a more intimate relationship with the surrounding air, because our ego and our astral body are then directly in the air. Awake, we direct our breathing from within. Asleep, we do it from outside, from the soul. Consider that on the one hand the air, at least a certain quantity of it, is at one moment within the human organism, and then out of it. And on the other hand that the entire human constitution, from the physical body to the ego, takes part in the breathing process. And you will see why we must closely observe the nature of this interaction between the human constitution and the air in order to understand the human being. You have probably all studied some chemistry, and you may recall the patience with which reasonably conscientious teachers explained to the children or young people that air, consisting of oxygen and nitrogen, is not a genuine chemical compound, but a sort of mixture. In air, then, the coexistence of oxygen and nitrogen is less than a chemical compound. It is a looser connection. How is this fact related to the human being? We find the cosmic counterpart within us in the loose connection between the astral and etheric bodies. Were oxygen and nitrogen chemically united, the etheric and astral bodies would also be inseparably joined together, and we would never be able to go to sleep. The inner relation between the astral and etheric bodies is mirrored in the outer constitution of the air, and vice versa. The human being is organized in accord with the cosmos. Within ourselves, we are a microcosm, although certain things that in the outer world are ordered in a physical way, in us are of a soul nature. Outside in nature, we are concerned with physical laws governing oxygen and nitrogen. Within us, with the laws of soul active in the relationship of the etheric and astral bodies. When we look at human beings and what happens within our organism, a scientist of the spirit can observe this. We realize that when we breathe, we have in the marvelous vibrations, which we can describe as vibrations of light, a swift intermingling of astral and etheric vibrations. This is an inner process of inhaling and exhaling. On the other hand, we see the same thing happening one step lower down in the physical process of out and in breathing. Contemplating this, we can positively see how human beings, as spirit-soul beings, are constantly freeing themselves of their physical surroundings, just as, in a mixture, the heavier parts become dislodged and fall to the bottom, while the lighter ones remain on top. Such processes take place in many different forms in the human being. But we must find them, as it were, among the things we observe, perceive, and take into ourselves in order that we may understand them. And then in meditative remembering, as I explained yesterday, transform them into artistic education. There is something more that we must consider. What is it that carries our ego into the physical world at birth when we descend from the spiritual world? It is our head. The head is, so to speak, the carriage in which the ego journeys into the physical world. And when it arrives, it transforms its whole condition of life at this transition from the spiritual to the physical world. Paradoxical as it may seem to one who looks at things externally, it is so that in the spiritual world, before we prepare to be born here on earth, we are in a constant state of motion. There, movement is our true element. Should we wish to continue this movement, we would never be able to enter the physical world. We are saved from this contingency through the head organism, which adapts itself to the rest of the organism. In a sense, then, our head becomes the chariot we ride into the physical world. But when it arrives, it comes to a halt and rests comfortably upon the rest of the body. Even when the rest of the body walks, the head does not join in. Just as persons who ride in a carriage or in a train are themselves at rest, the ego, which before birth was in constant motion, comes to rest once it has descended to earth. It ceases to carry out its former movements. This points to something of extraordinary significance. When modern embryologists study the development of the human embryo in the mother's womb, they observe that at first the head is large and definitely shaped in comparison to the other amorphous members that take shape later. Yet they proceed to assume that all the phenomena are of uniform importance. In this respect, modern embryology, is really rather limited. So much so, in fact, that it is difficult to find common ground for discussion with present-day physiologists. Their thinking works on an entirely different plane. What matters is that fertilization acts primarily upon the limb nature of the human being, upon parts other than the head. Essentially, the head receives its configuration from the whole cosmos, not from the Father. The human head is in fact not conceived from the male parent, but out of the cosmos. Furthermore, the head, as potentiality, already exists in the unfertilized human cell, in which the head, while still under a cosmic influence, is affected by the fact that fertilization acts first upon the rest of the organism. Not until the embryo begins to develop do the effects of the embryonic development work back upon the head. Thus we can discover, even by studying embryonic development quite externally, but by really studying it, that the head forms itself out of the mother's body before any direct influence by fertilizing forces has been exerted. It is just like building a carriage in a workshop, a carriage that is then to carry a passenger. They come toward each other. In the same way, the head is prepared in order to receive into itself the descending human ego. And for a long time after birth, really through all the formative years, a human being bears traces of this confluence of the human and the cosmic organizations. When the spirit of the education we want to nurture here has entered the teacher, I should like to say as a genuine soul habit, a result will be that teachers facing a class will be enormously fascinated by what takes place in the individual children. Even between the 7th and 14th years, certainly perceptible only to intimate observation, a distinct differentiation can be made between a certain withdrawal or retreat of a superhuman organization from the head and a permeation of the head with forces streaming up and pouring in from the rest of the organism. You must think all of this over in conjunction with what I said in the first two lectures, because one thing has to be balanced by the other. It must always be interesting for the teacher to study the difference between the sculptural form of the child's head and the structure of the rest of the organism. But one must look at the two phenomena in different ways. If you want to consider the changes that take place in the head, you must bring yourself to be a sculptor. But to consider the changes in the rest of the organism, you must bring yourself to be a musician, imbued with eurythmy. As for the latter, there is no point in observing how the fingers grow, for example, but one should note any changes in the kind of motions the children make. That indeed reacts back upon the shaping of the organism, though not through the structural, but through the dynamic elements. If someone has excessively long arms or legs, these will be heavier than normal. It is not their form that has a distinct effect, but rather the force of weight that they work with. And it is this weight that mingles with the musical forming of the movements. If we want to form a correct judgment of someone whose arms and legs are so long that they don't know what to do with them, we must approach such a person with a judgment alive to music, with an intimate judgment filled with life. We must feel how the child's legs keep crossing and recrossing because they are too long and keep getting into each other's way, and therefore the motion is abnormal. Or the arms never know what they are meant to do because of their excessive weight. How wonderful it is to think that through spiritual science one gets to know the human being so intimately by applying such knowledge. One will then no longer observe matters from the standpoint of the emotions as one had considered them before. When we see someone with small hands and arms, we will immediately say to ourselves, well, there's no great urge in that person to hit someone. but when arms and hands are too heavy and long, the impulse to hit out must be charged to that person's karma, their destiny, and not judged from an emotional point of view. Keeping such things in mind brings us much closer to one another, especially to those who are still developing, for we will discover a remarkable secret. Out of this person's bodily form, as you will be able to say when you study it as we have, I can determine how he or she has developed, and the whole composition of his or her soul. I find the significance of a certain shape of head, a certain weight of arms and legs, and so forth. Whether someone steps delicately along on tiptoe, or, like Fichte, whose complete figure bore witness to the fact, walks firmly, setting down his heels, tells us an immense amount and gives us the feeling that we are learning to know human beings much better. Of course, these things do not reveal any personal or intimate secrets. They are experiences we have with others in a human and social interaction that become more intimate between teacher and child during instruction. A feeling can also arise that whenever we meet someone, there is something to learn about them when we see them face to face, and something else when we see them from the back. We should let life itself engrave in us our understanding of the nature of life. For example, a student of Fichte's who understood life correctly would have looked at Fichte from the front during his lectures in order to take in what he said. However, in order to get to know Fichte's character, he would have had to look at him from behind, for this would disclose his whole manner and build. The formation of the back of his head, his back and hunched shoulders, the way he moved his hands and carried his head, all this fairly challenged the observer to see in Fichte precisely the personality he was in the world. Remarkable things come to light if you get to know children in this way. That is, if you are the sort of teacher who is inclined toward an understanding directed to matters of destiny, and not the sort who gets angry at emotional children, continually nags at them to sit still and be quiet, and finally throws the inkpot at them, saying, "I'll teach you how to be quiet." This is a rather drastic way to put it, but even if the reaction were less radical, we teachers and educators must recognize it as wrong. If we can get away from such behavior and direct our anthroposophical study of the human being more toward children's bodily form, so that their organism tells us something of their soul nature, we may come to know that we are treating them differently from the usual way. And, wonder of wonders, by approaching the children like this, we learn to love them, and we shall gradually understand them with greater and greater love. In just this way we shall gain a powerful feeling of support for teaching and educating the child lovingly. These are the ways we acquire the right feelings and attitudes as educators and teachers. It would be a mistake to believe, for instance, that one could become a composer by studying a textbook on music theory or learn to paint from a book on aesthetics. A person doesn't become a painter like that, but rather by learning to use color, by acquiring the necessary skill in handling color, and so forth. To become a sculptor, one must learn to understand the forms of an organism, and this is intensely interesting in the art of sculpture or elsewhere. As a sculptor, you will have quite a different feeling when modeling a head from the feeling you have when forming the rest of the organism. When working on the head, you will constantly have the feeling that the head is working on you from within, so that you must retreat from it, that something coming out of it is pressing against you. In modeling the rest of the organism, on the other hand, you feel that you are pressing in, while this section of the organism is withdrawing from you. So your feelings are exactly opposite in modeling the head and modeling the rest of the body. And this shows how necessary it is to learn the appropriate approach in every single case. The same holds true in the field of education. If you expected to glean how a class should be handled from a textbook on education, it would be exactly the same as trying to become a painter by means of a textbook on aesthetics. Nothing will come of it. But if you put into practice the anthroposophical knowledge of the human being as we are doing here, the talent for education will take hold of you. Many more people have this potential talent than you would imagine. Following this first step, you will acquire certain other qualities that every good teacher needs. There is no subject on which more nonsense is talked today than education. Although so many people take an extraordinary interest in it, one finds such talk particularly distressing because it affects the next generation. But especially in education, as in so many other fields, popular slogans can be confronted by a deeper grasp of human nature. We can understand well-meaning lay people saying that instruction must be a pleasure for the children, but even teachers use the phrase, and it should be strictly discredited when passed on by professionals. If you consider how it is in reality, you must ask, how should a teacher go about making the children radiantly happy when there are particularly difficult things for the children to overcome? Or think about what children are like and realize that they have to be in school from morning till night. How will you contrive to give them nothing but pleasure and then more pleasure? It simply cannot be done. It is one of those phrases coined by people who have no contact with reality. The simple fact is that certain things give children no pleasure, and yet they must be done. For one thing, if teachers were to give children nothing but pleasure, the children would be unable to develop a feeling for duty. For this can only be achieved if we learn to overcome ourselves. So it is not a question of nothing but pleasure, but of gaining the children's love through the art of our educating, so that under our guidance they will do things they dislike doing, or even things that make them suffer a bit. Bring love to your teaching, and if you succeed in awakening the right kind of love in the children, something besides joy will develop in them. Loyal affection and devotion to the teacher will grow in the children, so that they come to feel, there are many difficult things we must do, but for that teacher I will do the hard things. You see that in looking at teaching and educating, we have arrived at a different method of working from what is commonly thought to be pedagogical. What we have discussed here will show you that we can overcome many of the difficulties in the classroom by coming to understand how to create the right relationship between teacher and pupil. The end of Lecture 4.